So 21 years ago, June 3rd, 2005, I received a phone call, a cell phone call, from local detectives telling me they needed to meet with me. And when I met with them, I was told that my daughter had been murdered earlier that day. She had just graduated college 20 days before that.
Your life in a second changes, and as you're having to share the information with your family.
Right.
And that they've lost either a granddaughter, a daughter, a sister.
Right.
You can literally watch the shift in each person as their whole world crumbles.
Right. And it's the thing that could never happen.
Well, it's the thing that's never supposed to happen. When we talk to the victims, you want to hear a little bit more of their personal story because it helps whoever's listening identify with maybe a portion of who they are or a portion of that story to go, oh, God, that's me.
My threshold is if I get a black eye, I'm out the door. Well, you know that line gets moved. If he breaks one of my bones, I'm out the door. If you want to talk to a man who dismisses any sort of statistics or any sort of stories about, oh, yeah, it's not that bad for women out in the world, talk to your mother, talk to your daughter, talk to
Call
your
me.
Girlfriend.
I'll tell them.
Talk
Call
to your
me.
Divorce lawyer.
If I had to look back to say what I wish I'd been taught when I was younger, boundaries would have been a big one.
Let's say you discover this person's in an abusive relationship. This person's on the receiving end. That person, it's not that different from alcoholism. That person has to decide when that relationship is over.
I wish you did not have the tragedy in your life that brought you to where you and I are having a conversation. But I will say that you are an example of what to do when tragedy strikes your life. You turned it into a mission to help others. And I'm just getting chills now talking about it. The information shared in this podcast is intended for entertainment purposes only. It should not be construed as legal advice or a substitute for seeking professional legal advice. I'm Michelle Locke, and this is Love Less Law. Now, today we are joined by one of my favorite human beings, Bill Mitchell. He is an author and the podcast host of When Dating Hurts. And he started his journey because he had the unfortunate experience that no parent ever wants of losing his daughter to dating violence. Bill has dedicated his life to helping people recognize unhealthy relationships, see the red flags, coercive control, and the warning signs that are too often missed. His work, I have no doubt, has helped lots of people over the course of over 20 years see the light of what dangerous relationships can look like. And I have no doubt that Bill, through this journey, has saved more women and men just like his daughter. This is a powerful and very sensitive conversation that discusses the dark side of dating, violence, coercive control, and when you need to be brave enough to ask for help. And also brave enough to know that there is no shame in being a victim. Thank you, Bill, so much for being here today.
Thank you for asking me to join with you.
Bill, your work began with the loss of your daughter. I mean, horrific. And I know you've probably told the story a million times, but can you tell everyone again, how did you get started down the road you're on right now?
Well, what I've been doing for the last 21 years, I never would have thought to do or chosen had I thought to do it. So 21 years ago, June 3rd, 2005, I received a phone call, a cell phone call, from local detectives telling me they needed to meet with me. And when I met with them, I was told that my daughter had been murdered earlier that day. She had just graduated college 20 days before that. And so, you know, you can imagine everything's different now. You know, you're on.
Well, I mean, that's every parent's worst nightmare is getting that call.
Right.
I mean,
so you kind of stand there, and it's, I remember thinking, okay, I picture Kristen. I know what death is. I know what murder is. That's the end of that. I wonder where we go from here. You know, now it's just fact gathering and how did it happen? But no matter how it happened or whatever details, the end result is there.
Yeah.
Somewhere in that evening, I had to, soon after that, talk with my wife and son and my parents. Her parents were not living at that time. And I just got to watch them in our family room one by one change their lives.
Yeah.
Everything was different. But somewhere in the midst of that evening, I had a combined thought that hit me. And one of them was, I don't know where this is going, but I know that this will present a responsibility on how we handle ourselves. But it'll also be an opportunity, although I have no idea what that would be.
Yeah, because, I mean, it's your life in a second changes, and as you're having to share the information with your family.
Right.
And that they've lost either a granddaughter, a daughter, a sister.
Right.
You can literally watch the shift in each person as their whole world crumbles.
Right. And it's the thing that could never happen.
Well, it's the thing that's never supposed to happen.
Right. Especially, you know, it's, I mean, everything's bad when you lose a child. His sickness, car accidents, any number of things that can happen. But someone taking someone else's life, that one you can't get your head around ever. We're 21 years later, and I still don't get why anybody gets so mad that they would do that to somebody that they claim they care for at some time. Maybe even said they loved her. I don't know.
Yeah, and he was her boyfriend for how long?
Something like 4 or 5 months. It wasn't that long.
Not even that long. And you had met him at her graduation, right?
We met him 20 days earlier at her graduation. And what was so strange, because I don't normally have thoughts like this, was when I shook his hand and just looked at him, shook his hand, I thought, I hope I never have to tangle with this guy.
What was it, if you don't...
being in a fight.
What was it about him that raised, those red flags for you?
You know, it's very strange to try to figure out what that was. It was almost like this visceral animal feeling of this isn't good. I don't like this.
Yeah.
I picture fighting this.
Just so we know, where is he currently?
He is in the middle of Pennsylvania in a prison.
Right where he needs to be.
He won't be there forever. He wound up in the end pleading. He got second degree murder in Pennsylvania, which means 15 to 30 years. Now he's done 21 of those 15 to 30. 15 to 30 means that you must do 15 and you will not do more than 30. So he's in his 22nd year. And there was just very recently another parole board hearing, the fifth one. And we do not know the result of that as yet. Probably we'll know within the next month or so. And they could say, okay, you've done enough. You're out.
Yeah. How does that affect you and your family? Like every time that parole hearing comes about? Because I think at this age, he's probably having a parole hearing. Is it annually?
He is at the annual, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So tell me about that. Like how that, because I can only imagine.
It brings back those early moments just as real as they were when they happened. I mean, it brings it all back because you can't help but go through everything you learned at that time. We, of course, learned eventually. We didn't know that first day, but eventually we knew what he did and what the aftermath was of what he did and how he faked that he had been attacked first. He tried to make it look like defense. But it brings it all back very, very vividly. That's about all I can tell you. You know, and it hits the three of us differently. I think my wife just kind of goes into a big depression and makes me feel combative, and my son is somewhere in the middle of those two. My son was 17 when this happened, so now he's 38.
And that was his older sister, probably who he...
By 4 years, yeah.
...looked up to, idolized, like all the things that little brothers do when they've got an older sister.
I never once saw anything that resembled sibling rivalry. They were great pals.
Oh, that's nice.
Very supportive, right? Not everybody
that's
can
nice.
Say that.
What is it about... And we see in the news recently, you'll see that you've got some people that end up killing their intimate partner, right? And instead of actually going to trial, they plead right before the trial starts, right? And so what you see is even though they're playing and taking, in theory, accountability, I think what they're oftentimes doing is limiting their range of possible exposure, right?
Yes, exactly.
And the concern that I think, or I think the issue for a lot of victims' families, is that they don't get the closure that can come with trial.
Yes.
And if that affects them mentally, the plea even more so, because you've gone through this whole criminal justice system, you're anticipating the trial, you're anticipating that your daughter gets her day in court, and then they plea. So was there something similar with you, and your family when he did a plea instead of going to trial?
So this is the way it went. It didn't go exactly the way you put it.
Okay.
So what happened was when there was a date that was about 6 or 7 months after he killed Kristen that we could have gone into court. And within a week or two before that, the defense attorney who was court appointed, he said he needed a continuance, or he asked for a continuance, which he got to gather more evidence at that time, which, by the way, he never did. But he basically called a timeout on the field. So that took us through the end of that year, through the whole holiday period into the next year, with no idea of when the machine starts up again. So 2 or 3 months passed, and then a date was established, which was almost to the day that she was killed. It was almost exactly 1 year later. It was like a year and a day later. And at that point, the guy that did it wanted to plea. And his attorney didn't want him to, but he wanted to, and he's in control of his own life that way.
Yep.
So that went to the prosecution working on our team, and they wanted to go into court. And we talked with them, and they were trying to go in because they tried to get him on first-degree murder. Or if they couldn't get him on first, they tried to get him on third. And second-degree murder is a whole different category. So it's either first or third. And we did not feel, from what we had heard, that there was enough of a reason to think that they'd actually be able to pull off first-degree in a courtroom.
Okay.
So we looked at it like, well, wait a minute. We're going to go into court hoping for third, and the guy that did it is willing to accept third. So it's, as I said to the district attorney, you mean to tell me that we get the outcome we want without having to play the game? It's almost like winning without having to play the game. And he said, that's correct. And I'm like, then why are we doing this?
Mm-hmm.
Going into court, anything can happen. And even one of the people on the prosecution team said that, never forget the O.J. Simpson case. You could have a lot of really good evidence and have something slip and go wrong. All it takes is 12 people on that jury looking at this guy and thinking things like, well, her life is gone. And it seems like kind of a crime of passion. So why ruin two lives? Let's just make this some kind of a...
it's like involuntary manslaughter.
Yes, in this case, it would be voluntary manslaughter, which we knew would probably wind up with him getting 4 to 7 years max, which if he's a good boy in prison, would never do the seven, could do 3 or 4. So that was a nightmare. So we thought, come on, guys, let's go with this third degree thing, take the plea, and that's what we wound up doing. We had to talk the district attorney into it. Not an easy day.
That's interesting. From my perspective,
yeah,
what you all did as a family, that was the most logical, well thought out, how do we best get the best result for our daughter that we can, right? And because some people just want the pound of flesh in the courtroom. They want the defendant to take the witness stand, they want them to be crossed, or they want them to admit what they did, which they're never going to do for the most part.
Yes.
But they want some kind of, not nail in the coffin, but they want their day. They want their day to stay in court and say, you're an asshole.
I mean, in your mind, you would think, I want justice, and I want them to put him away forever. But that was not a lock. It never is a lock. So now the question
justice,
could be, well, since that time, do you wish you had gone the other way? No, but we certainly have thought about it. But to me, it's like you played the game and you had an outcome. Yeah, you can go back and say, gee, I wonder if we would have done this and this, you know, could we have won or could we have had a better thing? It's like, well, you don't get to play it anymore. That was back in...
Yeah, hindsight's always 2020.
Yeah, that was 2006 when that was all happening, you know, the following year.
Yeah, and your course of doing this, what have you learned about who are the people that engage in this behavior?
Yeah, I mean, it's just, it could be anybody. I mean, you know, we live in a very nice neighborhood. And I can't picture something like this going down on the next cul-de-sac, so to speak. But it very well could be. I mean, the statistic that you hear is that 1 in 3 women will suffer serious physical violence at the hand of an intimate partner during their lifetime. And typically, it happens between the ages of 16 and 24, but can happen to any woman at any age. I've only said this thousands of times.
Yeah, sounds like you know what you're talking about. But it's true.
At least I memorize what I'm talking about. I don't know if I know what I'm talking about. But one thing I looked up before knowing I was coming here, you know, in anticipation of coming here, I looked up, because I really had no idea, the prevalence of breast cancer in our lifetime now. What is the prevalence of breast cancer? And the answer is 1 in 3 women will develop breast cancer in their lifetime, and that's a statistic from the American Cancer Society. Now, I'm sure a lot of women walk around hoping, wow, you know, I know of a lot of people who have gotten breast cancer. I got to really get my mammograms and checkups and, oh my God, my mother had a problem with that. It's probably coming my way. And it seems like just about everybody's on full alert. I'm talking about 1 in 3 women will suffer serious physical violence. 1 in 3. And the thing with the one that we're here to talk about, you know, the intimate partner violence, dating abuse, domestic violence. If somebody on your cul-de-sac, keep coming back to cul-de-sac, but if someone on your cul-de-sac has breast cancer and all the people in the street know each other, there's a good possibility that this woman who has this may say, oh, you know, I had this exam the other day and then I sat down with my doctor and, oh my God, I got this going on. I can tell you if she has a horrible abuse situation going on in her house, she's not going to run around and tell her neighbors about it. So it's kind of a crime of embarrassment, and it's and you feel shame. A lot of women feel shame, even though they don't necessarily bring it on. You know, it's kind of
well, they feel shame because I can tell you from my perspective, it's we're raised to be, you know, self-sufficient, confident women, and a lot of us that get, you know, highly educated and have professional careers, the last thing that we ever want to do is say, yeah, I let him beat me, or yeah, I let him control me, or yeah, there was so much coercive control, I didn't know whether up was down or down was up, because the front that we put on for everyone else is, we're fabulous, we're amazing, we've got it all together, we are the complete package, and the reality is we're barely surviving in the house.
It's true, and it doesn't happen on day one. You know, when you meet that person might seem like the answer to all the problems in your life. You know, you're thinking, wow, I think I'm in love, or at least I'm very much attracted to this person, and they put on a nice mask, and everything seems to be just great. You might get little glimpses of things being not quite there, but you're thinking, well, yeah, there's some rough spots, but we could probably work that out over time. I mean, my God, we're in love. Look at us. Yeah, this is
or I can change him. Or he just, right. And I hear this one, it's, he just needs someone to understand him.
Right.
And I'm like, no, he doesn't need anyone to understand him. But it really, and then what I see is that they can mask it for a little while, right? They can mask it for a little bit.
Yes.
But then they get to a point, and it's usually once there's an engagement, once there's a marriage, once they know you're stuck, right? And it can be stuck financially, it could be stuck emotionally, it could be stuck legally if you're married. But once they know they have you, then you start seeing the real side come out. And then you start seeing, after you get married, after the wedding's over, then you see the, you know, the actual difference between Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
Yeah, that's just unfortunately the way it goes. It doesn't all
no,
happen.
No, it is. And it's the smartest of people, like, and I always say that it doesn't matter how smart you are. It doesn't matter how educated you are. It doesn't matter how successful you are. And it doesn't matter what color you are. Everyone can be the victim of intimate partner violence, period. And there's not a stereotype for who falls victim to it. There's not a stereotype of the type of personality that falls victim to it. It is, if you were looking at 1 in 3 women experience this in their lifetime, that means it runs the gamut. It runs through all personalities. It runs through all socioeconomic status. Runs through all education levels. Like, it runs through everything. And I don't know that people realize that. I mean, that it really can happen to your sister, your mother, your aunt, your niece, your best friend. And the chances of you knowing about it within a reasonable amount of time of it happening, slim to none. Because the people will sit there and suffer with it. And some will suffer for 20 years or more because they don't ever want to admit they got it wrong.
And oftentimes they're just so trapped by that.
Oh, no. And, the other problem that I've seen, because I see it on the flip side with divorces, is they lose one, a part of themselves. Two, they're so used to surviving in the chaos and so used to navigating the abuse, they don't have time to think about anything else other than surviving. So you can't get out if all you're trying to do is survive each and every day and not have a mental health breakdown and make sure the kids get to soccer, to basketball, to baseball, to all their activities, make sure that you've got dinner done, make sure that, they get stuck in their lives and can't take a step back to go, I'm legit getting abused. And Jake and I have talked about this before, and Bill, I'm sure you have, is that the violence doesn't have to be you leave with a black eye. Like, I would tell you that those are, and it's never easy to deal with it, so let's start with that. But those heal. It's the psychological torment that some victims will never fully recover from.
Yeah, the PTSD.
I think some of the studies actually show that the abuse, like narcissistic abuse, actually changes your brain. Like, reprograms your brain. That's how serious that type of abuse is. I don't think most people realize it. And I think that there is some denial, maybe not the right word, but, and Jake, I think you can probably speak to this too, but some, well, it's not so bad because he didn't hit you. Or it's not so bad because you weren't beaten. And I'm like, what are your thoughts?
One of the things that we get often when dealing with stalking survivors is people will come forward and they'll say, well, my story is not as bad as some of the other ones, right? And so they try to like quantify and sort of rank the level of trauma. And you really can't do that. Everybody's trauma is specific. Everybody's situation is unique. So I think that ultimately we're in this position, as Michelle just said, is that people tend to concentrate on certain things. And in their own mind, they'll almost pacify their own victimization because they think they're less of a victim because they haven't been put in a hospital, okay? Or they haven't had their family targeted, or they haven't had someone try to run them off the road or track every single electronic device they have. So one of the things I'm sure we all have dealt with is where people who are suffering from things who become these victims and survivors have the ability to almost sort of water down their own experience, unfortunately, which also leads to the lack of reporting when it comes to these things. And we find this with stalking cases a lot, is so many of the people that have come forward is they've never reported it because they didn't think they'd be believed. They told family members and family members said, just ignore it and it'll go away. You know, maybe they did go to law enforcement, and law enforcement, you know, when it comes to especially cyber, they'll say, you know, get offline.
They tell you to get off social media.
Yeah, eliminate your social media accounts. Get rid of your phone. I mean, all things that in this age, it incapacitates you at this point, and it's not a realistic solution. So I'm sure that, you know, from that standpoint, even Bill, that you face this often where you're dealing with people and they'll share stories and they'll say, well, Bill, my story is not as bad as yours. My story is not as bad as the guest you had on 3 weeks ago. So that's something we should probably bring up in terms of when people try to quantify their own trauma.
Yeah, I've had a number of people who have come on and they're going through their story on my podcast, the When Dating Hurts podcast. I've had people come on that said that they had all these horrible things. They had all this emotional abuse, all this gaslighting, all these mind games. You know, you can go down the list of all the emotional, horrible tricks that are pulled upon them, all the different abuse. But this one woman said she figured up until the time that she got a black eye that it really didn't add up to abuse yet. You know, she just had to have that. That for her was the quintessential key. Oh my God, I'm in an abusive marriage.
That was the litmus test. It had to turn violent.
Right. It's like you had to see blood or something. You know, you just had to. So, you know, that's why the work that all of us, you know, the work that all of what we do, we want to put it in people's minds that, and do it enough time with enough repetition and strength that you hope the light comes on early, where they're seeing somebody, dating somebody, thinking they're falling in love or whatever, they think this relationship's going to end up in some kind of a partnership. And you hope that when they witness certain things, or they're driving in the car and they're talking about something and this comment comes in that just seems wrong, kind of edgy, you know, that they start thinking, wow, you know, this is really weird, because I was feeling really good up until this moment, but boy, that sounds like what I heard on that podcast, or I heard somewhere else, or I saw a movie about it, or read a book about it, or, you know, those things. That's what we want really to do. That's when it's great. The other point I've wanted to make is that we want to put out tons of stuff, and we have to, you know, unfortunately it has to be captivating, has to be entertaining. I hate to use that word when someone's coming on and telling their survivor story, but you're not going to listen to it if it's boring, or if it, I don't know, if it's just a bunch of crying, you know, after a while, everything, that all gets tiring. So, and I'm just very fortunate because I have a lot of survivors, usually one new one a week, every Tuesday, and the people just somehow magically tell their stories very clearly, chronologically, clearly. You know, I mean, I can just kind of sit back and just listen to the story unfold. I'm just happy to be part of these stories. But that's a wonderful way to teach people, because I think we'll all listen to stories more than we're going to go. You know, if you shove a fact sheet in front of somebody, they gloss over. You know, once you get past the 1 in 3 statistic and maybe you see some other, like, well, big numbers, small numbers, big numbers, small numbers, terminology I've never heard before. You know, there's a lot of things like that. So I think if we take it gently and spoon feed them what love bombing is and what isolation really is, and, you know, I could go on breadcrumbing. There's all kinds of things.
There's so many things. Like, we could talk for 8 hours and just cover 3 areas, yes. Right? Yeah, I mean, really.
On the podcast lately, I was telling Jake this before we came on, but I've been doing 15-minute episode just with me talking about things like love bombing and coercive control. And, you know, I just pick out different things and just go with them. And I think that from some of the comments I've gotten back, is those are very, very helpful. But I think the stories are the best way to serve it up.
When we talk to the victims, you want to hear a little bit more of their personal story, because it helps whoever's listening identify with maybe a portion of who they are, or a portion of that story, to go, oh God, that's me.
Right.
Right.
Because that's what happens.
Yeah.
That's me, or that's my sister, or I work with somebody, or I had a college roommate that had that going on. Oh my God, I didn't realize it was like that.
Out of all the interviews that we've all done, and I don't know if either of you have had this experience, but nobody wants to identify as a statistic. Nobody wants to say, I'm one of those 1 in 3, I'm one of those 1 in 7, I'm one of those. What tends to resonate is, as you mentioned, Bill, personal experiences where people can put themselves inside this first person view of something and identify through the emotion, through the journey, through the details. But there's something that resonates about these first person stories that's very unique, and it stays with people. And you find these sort of people that come from, you don't even know where they, how they find your show, right? You don't know how they find you, but they're searching, they're looking. And one of the most common things I've found with people, and this is what I think education has to start very young with young people, because there's a certain thing when you mentioned before, like, well, my threshold is if I get a black eye, I'm out the door. Well, you know that line gets moved. If he breaks one of my bones, I'm out the door. Okay.
Oh, it so gets moved. He didn't really mean it. It was an accident. He didn't mean to give me a black eye.
This is the ultimate problem, is that we're not teaching boundaries early enough, and we're not teaching safety. And when it comes to this, the way I look at this is that men have a responsibility to conduct themselves in an ethical and moral way and take accountability for their own actions. And we're not teaching young men how to navigate the world being from a position of trying to understand what it's like to be a young woman in the world. Okay. We're not really doing that to any real context. And we're using sort of the navigation through this sort of manosphere where it becomes something that is more about battle and toxic and self-protection, when in reality, it's going to come down to compassion and relatability to this. And I often say this is like, if you want to talk to a man who dismisses any sort of statistics or any sort of stories about, oh, yeah, it's not that bad for women out in the world, talk to your mother, talk to your daughter, talk to
call
your
me.
Girlfriend.
I'll tell them.
Talk
call
to your
me.
Divorce lawyer. Really, that's what it boils down to. I think you need to have the conversations at home to understand what, because there are these invisible scars, these invisible stories that no woman in your life will ever share unless you ask her. Because that's just the part of being a woman in the world, and it's expected and this and that. And we always joke about the man or the bear or whatever. That just doesn't come from a trivial place. Okay. I was raised with three younger sisters. I didn't get the speeches they got. I never got, you know, protect yourself in a parking lot. I never got, you know, all these sort of safety tips about where to go, where not to go. Don't ask strangers for help if you get a flat tire. Like all these things never crossed my path. So I think that men... It needs to be understood, and it needs to be a conversation. And Bill, what you do, and obviously what I do through my work as well, is highlight bad acting males in most of these cases, right? But it doesn't, as you and I both know, it doesn't stop there. It has to do with conversations like this to say holding a male's accountable. It's not male bashing. It's male recognition of understanding what your capabilities are and understanding what your responsibilities are to be a true man out in the world and understand what kind of other things that you are responsible for. Because at the end of the day, we talk about statistics. It's like people don't assault themselves. Like there was a conversation when I was growing up. If a woman, especially on college campuses, if a woman goes out with a short skirt or whatever, that she's drawing attention to herself. It was never like, well, maybe men shouldn't rape. Well, maybe men shouldn't assault. Well, maybe men should be responsible and accountable for their own actions. Never did that. That didn't come up for me till Me Too. That's way too late for the conversation.
Listen, I remember a judge on the bench chastising the victim, the female victim, saying it was partly her fault she was sexually assaulted. This was a female judge to a female victim. It was awful. But this would have been, before 2010. I can tell you that. How soon before 2010? But between 2002 and 2010, and like the ripple effect through the courthouse was like, how could she have done this? Like, to this day, I had completely forgotten about that, Jake, until you were talking about, you know, why don't we just teach men not to rape? And this female judge crucified the female victim for being hurt, partly her fault that she got raped.
All this stuff has to start early. It really does.
Yeah, and you know, I'd asked the question of a domestic violence counselor, and this was back in the early days of my podcast, so it's like five, six years ago. But I really didn't know the answer. I just didn't think far enough. But I said, well, I mean, how do you go into middle school and talk about this? And the answer was, we don't. We go in and talk about healthy relationships. We talk about how to handle each other, how to deal with conflict, how to communicate. And if you think of it, the way you interact with other people when you're in middle school is really not that different when you're 25 in terms of respect and listen to what the other person, like for instance, negotiating, what are we going to do today? You know, if you're in a control relationship, one of you is not going to have much to say. Or if you do, it's not going to be heard, and you're not going to get your way anyway. So relationships are relationships. And so you can start pretty early to get into how to interact with other people without somebody's feelings getting hurt and really meaning it. I mean, really, it takes some practice.
Because now that I'm back in the dating world, although as opposed to my normal personality, just diving headfirst into anything, like I'm barely dipping my toe in because I'm just... I never learned the boundaries. And I know in my own personal relationship with my ex-husband, the boundaries kept shifting. The boundaries kept moving. I never stuck to my own. If I had to look back to say what I wish I'd been taught when I was younger, boundaries would have been a big one. I have to say this, I don't fault my mom in any way for any of this because you teach what you know. You teach what you're familiar with. And my dad was an abusive asshole that broke every boundary with probably every woman he was ever with. I mean, womanizing, you know, every bad descriptor of masculinity would have been him. And so my mom taught me what she could. And so, and I'd love her forever for it. But if I had to go back, I would say boundaries. I didn't learn, because no means no is a boundary. But there's so many more boundaries that should never be crossed in a relationship. And when they are, they give all the signs of where the relationship is going to head that I didn't realize. Like, I just didn't realize. And so I got stuck in an extremely toxic marriage for too long. And Bill goes back to what I talked about earlier, is that you get stuck in raising kids, you get stuck in the bills, you get stuck in taking them to all their practices, and you, until you get space to breathe, you can't see what's going on.
Yeah, you're just trying to get through today.
Right.
You know, with what both of you were talking about, a couple thoughts. One of them is that I think we're taught throughout our lives what for us is normal. And normal isn't necessarily good. It's just, this is the way it is now. I mean, you can remember being in elementary school and it may be a little confusing at first, but finally you say, oh, I have a good sense of what an average day is like.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if growing up at home is a battleground, unfortunately, that's your normal.
Mm-hmm.
And I know I've often talked with survivors and I find myself saying, I'd like you to tell your story, but I'd like you to go back to the very beginning. I think that there are two ways growing up before you hit even 10. There are two ways that aren't helpful to you later in life. One of them is if one or both of your parents are abusive, that's not good for you growing up, especially like later. Or on the other hand, if your parents are wonderful, that's not too good either growing up, because you think that's the way life is going to be. And I think my daughter was very trusting because she grew up in a nice family. As I said earlier, got along with her brother, got along with her parents. And so she kind of tended to trust people. She never had any idea that someone's going to be some coercive monster, or that if he gets her in sort of a emotional headlock and she tries to break it one night, that he's actually going to kill her.
No one sees it coming. But that goes back to your daughter had sent in one of her last emails to your wife.
Right.
And described a fight, right, in one of her last emails. And it was a fight with the boyfriend. Did you, looking back now, because hindsight's always 20/20, is there something that you've taken away from that last, one of those last emails that you now apply like daily?
There are a couple of things. There was a phone conversation that my wife had with my daughter a couple of weeks before she was killed. My daughter was killed. And at some point, my wife was talking about the relationship and my daughter says, you know, Mom, it's not the perfect relationship. And my wife took it the way I would, which is, I don't know, this is something about the relationship that's clumsy. Kristen's dated other people. I mean, she's heading for 22 years old. So this guy will come and this guy will go and that'll be the end of it. Someone else will fill his spot. So my wife didn't pursue it any more than I would have. We're all really smart too late, of course, now. But questions I would have asked or my wife would have asked would have been things like, well, if it's not the perfect relationship, what's missing? Or if it's not the perfect relationship, what is the perfect relationship? You know, now I know to ask those questions. I know to go down those rabbit holes. And you have to do it really gently. But you pursue it. The mm-hmm. email you're referring to was not an email from my daughter to my wife. It was to me.
And okay.
It was within hours of her getting killed. So she wrote me an email and she mentioned a fight she had with this guy earlier in the day. And it was clear to me that it was a verbal confrontation she had with him. And that relationship was running rough a lot, we know from her friends. You know, in and out of like little breakups, come back together, little breakups and all. But he was just this controlling SOB kind of a guy. So she had this confrontation with him, and it led up to her saying, look, I really need to get some space, okay? And she put that in this email. I've looked at that email over the years. I mentioned it in my book, but there are a lot of places, and when I do a presentation, I'll actually show the email and then I'll show the next slide the same email with parts highlighted that jump off like warning signs. But I didn't know them then. You know, I'm just a babe in the woods, you know, compared to what I know now. You know, I could write books on this subject, and back then I couldn't write sentences on that subject. But she really felt like she needed space from that guy, and she was leading up to breaking up with him, and that's what she wound up doing in the early hours of June 3rd, and she wound up getting killed. What do I wish I had done? Well, I wish I knew about, I wish I knew what I knew, anything like I knew now, I know now. I wish I'd picked up the phone and just called her. You know, hey, tell me about this email. One of the emails that I read, there were several, we actually had three emails each back and forth on her last full day alive. We never had that in the 4 years she was in college. So she doesn't come out and say anything there like, I think this guy's dangerous and I think he's going to be violent. She's just saying he's just very controlling, and I told him I need space to be me, you know. So, and she spent the last day with a couple of guys who she graduated with because they were going off to their new jobs. One's going to New York, one's going to Texas. And so they're going to be out of there, and she was going off to work at General Mills in a few weeks. And I think that she'd probably reached the point where she thought, I don't see a big future with this guy. And the worst thing you can do is be by yourself and break up with somebody at 3 a.m., which is what
she did. Yeah, that's a bad idea.
Yeah.
Save breakups for middle of the day.
Well, yeah. And in a restaurant with police sitting in the next booth.
Yep.
That's actually, the best way was described, at least I feel the best way to do it, was described by the prosecutor. And she said, I would do it over the phone with someone else's phone. But I'd do it over the phone, and then I'd get out of town for a month or two if I could, which is not always easy, especially if you're a high school kid.
Yeah.
But besides the normal thought, normalization of things that shouldn't be normal, I think another thing that is that kind of goes with setting boundaries is having a good sense of self-esteem. That needs a lot of work.
Oh, for girls, it so does.
Right. I mean, my daughter was in and out of suffering from low self-esteem at different times now. If you knew her, you'd never know it. And if you saw pictures of her, you would never get it. You'd say, oh, my God, you, low self-esteem, you've got to be kidding me. Well, you can't know what's going on inside of somebody's head. You can't know when their confidence is ebbing and flowing. And I think with that in mind, a guy like this comes along with all of his problems, and I think that when you're not playing at your best game, I think you allow things to be around you or happen to you that you wouldn't normally let happen.
That is 1,000% accurate. If you are in a vulnerable state internally, that makes you the prime victim. It makes you the perfect victim.
Makes you the perfect target. And so the thing is this, that the people who really perpetrate, these people, it's not some nice guy who's just having a bad run of time. These are predators. These are offenders. They maybe haven't done something horrible yet, but it's coming. This is a practiced art. You mentioned mask before. It is a mask they've been working on. My daughter was 21. She was dating this guy who was 28, which is one of the many reasons, I guess, looking back, that I thought I never want to tangle with this guy. But this guy was highly practiced. So, you know, she was just perfect. I mean, she would put up with his stuff, and he knew how to reward, and he knew how to punish, which is another thing these predators do. If you go along with the program, you'll get some candy. You know, nice things will happen. Hey, look, don't drive your car. Take my keys. Take my car. Guy has a better car. There are different, you know, like we have a fight. We have a little breakup. Then I buy you a new cell phone because the one I smashed isn't working so well anymore. You know, just it's like knowing when to give the candy, knowing when to pull it away, when to step on it. That's you know, these people, I mean, they're scary people. And the more we can scare the truth into people about what to look for and all the warning signs we talk about. And people listening to this, if you don't know, just Google it. It won't take you but a second. And just start reading about this, because you're going to save your neck or somebody you care about. You know, it's not this again. It doesn't just happen off in some other part of the state or country.
It happens right next door.
Yeah, that was 2006 when that was all happening, you know, the following year.
And that was probably long before there was as much awareness as there is now.
You know, we're in an era now where everybody is on high alert when it comes to safety, red flags, scores of control, love bombing, breadcrumbing, all these terms now that are thrown about, especially within our podcast world. There was nothing like that back in 2005. When you were dealing with what was going on in your own life and in your daughter's life, there were so few signs there. There were so few signs that we now know of to be like real red flags. One of the problems that I've seen with many survivors that come forward, and not problems, but problems for them, is they shield a lot of this behavior. They don't necessarily want other people in their life to either worry or to advise them or to put them in a situation where they have to lean on them because they think that they can handle it. And that's a really common thing, especially stalking. All these things, DV, you know, SA, stalking, are very isolated things. And people live with these in their head before they even leave the words leave their lips. And I've seen this hundreds of times now at this point. I'm sure you have too. And so that's one of the challenges too, is how do we get people, especially in your own family, to share these things?
Yeah, well, you know, I think that, you know, one of the things that I anticipated that you might ask something like that. And I think that having a conversation with your child, let's say, or your friend, and it's got to be the right setting, whatever, it might be in the car, but it has to be the right setting. I would get into it like, what is out there nowadays that is bothering you? Is anything in your life really bothering you? And you hope that it might sneak out a little bit. Or you sit down with your daughter or son or whatever it is and their friends and see if you can have that conversation, okay? I would probably say if you've never had any of those conversations, then I'd probably find some other subject and get them a little bit used to the fact that a car ride could lead to a conversation. Because now, you know, here you are and here I am and we're going to talk. But I think that that's a good idea to get it going, you know?
I was a lot more open before I hit like 13 or 14, and then I didn't want to share shit, to be fair.
That's you know, every teenage boys I've raised too. I've got one that's about to be that age, yeah. And they clam up at about 12.
I think we all have been there before, right? Parents aren't necessarily the enemy if you're in a good household, but two things you don't want to happen. You feel uncomfortable with them prying in your business, right? And as you get more into it, I remember even with dating and things like that, it just becomes a very uncomfortable situation. So you have all these extra hurdles that you're dealing with. And it also, I'm sure the dynamic also, we talked about this, is like how a mother deals with a daughter, mother deals with a son, father deals with a daughter, father deals with a son. It's different dynamics. I know a lot of complicated mother-daughter relationships, but I know a lot of great father-daughter relationships, oddly enough. Like that seems to be, and I know a lot of great mother-son relationships. But for some reason, I know a lot of complicated father-son relationships, but a lot of mother-daughter relationships complicated. Some with, you know, tongue-in-cheek, but other ones are just like, yep, she gave birth to me and we're done. I don't know which line to go on that. But the reason I'm saying this is that that's why you have to start these conversations early and get them comfortable. And you have to put yourself in a role to try not to be judgmental. Because the first, you know, I've seen these every episode of a TV show. Like I remember watching The Sopranos, you know, Tony Soprano is obviously suspect for a lot of things. And his daughter's starting to discover what he's doing and how he makes his money. And they're going out and she's, you know, going around for looking for schools and things like that. And she ends up being in this position, and he shares a few things with her, and she shares a few things with him. But as soon as she shares with him, he goes, "What the fuck are you talking about? I can't believe you did it." And so all of a sudden, it caves in on him and her. So, you know, how do we even do that? Like you talk about the car ride, how many dreaded car rides can a child have? And I know, Michelle, you've been in those situations too. They're captive. They can't go anywhere. They don't have a license. They're too young. They have barely control over the stereo. What do you do?
I think one of the things is that I would probably, like if I heard this and I thought, okay, how would I apply this? I probably go into it thinking, okay, the next chance I have, I'm going to get into a conversation, and I want it to be light, and I don't want it to come off as interrogation. I'm going to put a hot lamp in their face and smoke a cigar and blow it in their face and all.
Oh, darn it. I'm like, that's the most effective way.
Next time, I'm not going to do that. But, you know, but you want to get that person talking freely, and it takes maybe a little practice. What I mean by that is there's something, there are these things that you can do to get people to talk that are so small, but they work so well. And one of them is you start talking about something, they start talking, and then you pause. You just don't talk, because somewhere in your mind and their mind, quiet doesn't work. And someone feels the need to fill it. Well, let them fill it. Let them talk. Let them talk. If you're fortunate, then maybe you can get to talking about things like relationships with the opposite sex. You know, maybe you'll get lucky. But the other thing is, if I could jump to this part, is let's say you do one of these days, something presents itself. Now you're hearing about, you know, it's not the perfect relationship or some variation like that, you know, at any age. But the thing is this, is that it would be really hard not to become emotional about it. Like maybe you already have feelings about this person that they're interested in and you don't like that person, which like the feeling I had, but then I don't know why, but I didn't. But you have to try to understand, and I have to like trust us talking today, that as much as you think it is, it's not about you. It's about the person it's happening to. And so that's why, as someone said earlier, don't be judgmental. Don't come down hard on it. Yes, I know you want the relationship over with. Yes, you might have a sense of where that relationship could go, especially listening to us or listening to my podcast or Jake's, you know, like nobody wants their kid stalked, okay? Nobody wants their kid dead. And nobody wants their kid in a domestic violence situation of any description. So it's asking you to do something that's not going to feel right. But you have to show a lot of patience. And one of the things to jump to this place, let's say you discover this person's in an abusive relationship. This person's on the receiving end. That person, it's not that different from alcoholism. That person has to decide when that relationship is over. I know you want it over with right now, or this afternoon, or tonight, or at least over the weekend, but that person has to get there. Because you have to understand, if that person's dealing with somebody who's super controlling, that controller is controlling that person. Until the person who's being abused gets to the place of bottoming out, much like the alcoholic, and says, I can't do this anymore, then you have a chance to be helpful and bring that person out of it. And that takes a lot of work, too. We haven't really talked about the fact that these horrible and abusive relationships take a long time to form, usually. They don't happen on the first date. They don't go horrible on the first date. There may be little symptoms, but they don't go really that bad. But they take a while to get really bad for the roots to really grow in there. And you can't just fix it today. It takes a while to get out of those relationships. I think it's important for a lot of people to understand that you need to, if you detect that it's happening to your friend or your child or a coworker, tag, you're it. You're involved. So what does that mean? That means maybe call the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 800-799-7233, which is also 800-799-SAFE. But call and say, look, I'm new at this. I don't know what to do, but apparently my child, my friend, my neighbor, my coworker is in a relationship that's horrible. It's abusive. I don't know what to do. And start getting some coaching or Google it, but start learning. And like I said, tag, you're it. You're in the game, whether you want to be or not. If somebody discloses to you that this is going on, it's up to you to start taking action. Maybe you get some more help. You know, maybe you get to a counselor or talk with a therapist about, what do I do?
I'm going to throw out a suggestion in real fast, because I think this is actually can be helpful, because sometimes it takes a person being forced to get out, right? And what I mean by that is, let me give you the best example. CPS, at least in Texas, will view that if domestic violence has occurred in front of the children, that that is neglectful supervision of the children, and they will intervene. So if you are in a situation, at least in Texas, and I would suspect that most CPS agencies have similar positions, and you know a friend or someone in your circle that their kid's involved and there's domestic violence going on in front of those children or around those children, they're exposed to it, to report it to CPS. Because then CPS comes out and does an investigation. And if they determine their credibility, like the kids are saying, oh yeah, we saw daddy like punch mommy, they're gonna make someone leave. They're gonna put a safety plan in. They're gonna mandate some services. And that may be what forces the issue. Now, the concern with that is always, well, does a person, is there more violence that occurs because now someone from a third party's agency is involved? Possibly, yes. I mean, that's, but I got to tell you, I'm like, getting outside eyes on the inside may force that person to get help and to get safe. And it may be the thing they need to get out, because it may be, well, CPS says I can't be around you.
Yeah, just that would be a nice breakthrough.
Yeah, I mean, just a thought.
Yeah, it takes something. You know, it could be just, I can't do this anymore. For some people, it is seeing, you know, so many times it's a guy doing it to a woman, so we might as well just get there, right? It's not always the case, but okay, it's the case quite a lot.
I would say it's the case the majority of the time.
I mean, you hear 95 to 5%, so I don't know if that's really right or not, but... Okay.
I don't know if that's right, because most men will not admit they've been abused.
Well, that's true. Try to get men to come on my podcast. Good luck. I think I've had maybe three.
No, men.
Three other guys
general...
have backed out within an hour of starting. So.
Yeah, because men do not want, to them, it is a lack of them being manly.
Right, right.
That
and if... Okay, let me see here. You're 6'2", she's 5'4", and she hits you and you put up with it.
Yep.
Really?
So I'm going to actually tell you, I know what the statistics show, and I can just tell you from what I see in the family law side of it, that some of those 5'2 women can be dangerous. I don't care how big the man is, because the man, in a lot of these cases, is taught to never hit back, so they don't.
Right.
And they take it because they also know the minute they swing back, they're going to get arrested.
Yeah.
Because I just think there's some general misconceptions about family law and how you handle hearings. And, you know, I can't tell you how many people have said that they were abused, but then their immediate response is, well, I didn't file a police report. And how many times I tell them, you don't need a police report for someone to believe that you're the victim of some kind of family violence. And the minute I tell them that, you should see the relief that comes on their face. They're like, well, I didn't have to file a police report. I'm like, I mean, would it be helpful if you did? Sure. But is it a requirement? Absolutely not. And it doesn't take away from whether it's a credible outcry or not. I mean, will a defense attorney or an opposing party in a divorce, opposing counsel, try to use that as, well, what must have been that not that serious because you didn't file the police report? But at the least at the level I'm doing, they're not calling police because their husband or significant others, a doctor, a lawyer, a nurse, a teacher, law enforcement, fireman, any of those jobs, if there's an arrest for family violence, they're losing their job. And that loses the income for the family. And so you can't afford the baseball, the basketball, the ballet, the piano, the car payments, the mortgage payment. And so they don't call. And so that's what I try to explain, is that you don't have to have a police report to be believed.
But collecting evidence, on the other hand, is a good idea.
100%. Collect as much evidence as you can.
Yeah.
Like if you're assaulted, take pictures of the bruises, right?
You know, I had a survivor on about 6 months ago, and she had a number of bruises on her arms, and she would get her phone, and she'd set her phone up, and she'd show it and take pictures. But her face wasn't in the picture. So by the time it got into the courtroom or whoever went in front of, they said, that could be anybody's arm. So
that's where is it, what I have learned through some of my litigation cases, metadata becomes unbelievably important in authenticating evidence.
Now, one of the things that that I wanted to just mention, just kind of walk through fairly quickly because I think it's so valuable, is after hearing a lot of stories and reading up, and I don't know when this was, probably 15 years ago, it occurred to me that, wait a minute, there's like a template that every abuser seems to follow. And so let me go through that. It's really five steps. You know, so the template has about five steps. I discovered this template after hearing so many stories, and the template has never varied that much. And here are the steps. So number one is fairy tale romance. It's not always like you hear the music in the background, everybody looks great, and the car's clean when you get in it. But all I'm saying is that it seems to start out pretty well. Like, wow, okay. And I know this one young woman said that she went out with this guy, she had a wonderful evening, he's spending all this money. The next day she's at work and two bouquets show up, and she thought, wow, I met the most wonderful guy I've ever met in my entire life. Okay. And that relationship, by the way, lasted just over a year. And it wouldn't make a good story, but if it was a great relationship, it wasn't. It was horrible. One of the things that he would do, by the way, is he bought her a puppy at one point, knew that she wanted a golden retriever. So one of the things would be is every time they'd have an argument, one way or another, he'd get the dog and steal it out of her apartment. And then if they got back together, the dog comes back. And he got it one time, and actually her father and her uncle went to his place and broke in and got the dog and brought it back. But anyway, number one, fairy tale romance. Everything just seems to be wonderful.
If you're swept off your feet, pay attention.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's like so many things. If it seems too good to be true, that's a warning sign. Okay. Yes, I'm sure there's some, it seems too good to be true that was wonderful and it went on forever and all that. I'm just saying,
that is the exception, not the rule.
Take it slow. Like, really take it slow. Okay. If it's that great, take it slow and it'll last. Okay. The second thing is that typically starts to come in. It doesn't happen the first date, maybe not the first week, but isolation. That person wants, in this case, he wants you all to himself. Okay. And part of that is to start knocking off all the branches you have in your tree of your life. So it's like, you know, we got together with your friends the other day. I don't really like those people that much. I really don't. I don't even know what you see in those people. I just think she's stupid. And I don't know what his deal is. I mean, the way he's looking at you and everything. So she's thinking, well, okay, if I'm with him, probably shouldn't be around them. Well, he doesn't like your parents that much either. Okay, doesn't like your dad, thinks he's creepy or something. I don't know what's going on with your dad. But this is over time, just isolating you. You like to play pickleball or you like to play tennis. I don't know what you see in that. I mean, it's hot out there. You're running around. I mean, wouldn't you rather be with me? We could go see a movie. We could go do something. But why are you doing that stuff? Or you like to ride horses. That costs a fortune. And then I don't even see you for two-thirds of Saturday. So, you know, it's like, eh. So you kind of want the relationship. And so you kind of stop dropping this other stuff. And before you know it, you're in this invisible prison of isolation. Isolation is step two. Step number three falls under the heading of threats of violence. That is when that person gets really loud sometime at you because you said something or you did something and he's really sorry. But you know, that reminded me so much of the way my mother used to talk with me. And I decided a long time ago never to put up with it. So I probably shouldn't have said that to you, but, you know, geez, or slamming on the brakes in the car because something's not going well and practically putting your head into the dashboard.
I'm gonna jump in for 1 second.
Yeah.
And this is a warning. If you're with someone in a car and that person makes you feel unsafe while you're in the vehicle with them, stop dating that person. Because if they're willing to make you feel that unsafe to start with, it ain't ever going to get better.
Yeah. You're complaining about going too fast and all of a sudden the car is going faster. You can see how that's a control issue. Oh, you don't like how fast I'm driving? You know, we're really going fast. But that's another threat of violence. You know, it's putting you into these positions where you're feeling really uncomfortable. And the message to you is you better comply. You better come along. Whatever signals I'm giving you, you might want to come along because you don't want to see what's coming next. Which takes me to the next step, number four, which is actual violence. Now, that doesn't happen all the time, but there are all kinds of violence. It could be a lamp that just missed your head as it went by, but it could be real-life violence. It could be somebody who slaps you, somebody who punches you, somebody who shakes you, somebody who literally strangulates you, which people sometimes call choking, but choking is when you eat food or something and it gets stuck in your throat. Strangulation is when someone is strangulating you and cutting off your airways. But it also ups the ante. You're really in the hitting the sweet spot of being a dead person one day. Because if that person's willing to do that to you, one day you may just find out what the next part of it is when that person doesn't let go. You know, and look, I've interviewed people who've been strangulated several times and they stayed in the relationship even after that. I mean, somebody strangulates me, I'd be so terrified I wouldn't go anywhere near that person. I don't care what they look like. But okay, that's actual violence.
Choking to me is one of the biggest indicators of potential lethality.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Mm-hmm. I mean, if somebody's willing to go that far, mm-hmm. and is doing something to you, if they don't stop, you will 100% be dead. You mm-hmm. will be in the past tense mm-hmm. from that point on. And then step number 5 is what I call convincing apology. Hey, look, I don't know. This has never happened to me before, okay? Especially if in the early stages. This has never happened to me before. I've never done anything like this. I've had a miserable week. You know, it's some kid in high school who says something like, look, you know, I spent all summer running around to get in shape for this team, and I was running up and down hills and all that stuff, and I get out there and I'm practicing with this team that was like 3-7 last year. They had a crap season, and I'm trying to make this team, and I get cut, okay? So I'm really upset about it, and I'm sorry about what happened, but I mean, look at my situation. Or the guy that comes home saying, look, I'm really sorry about throwing the food all over the place, you know, but I really thought I was going to get the promotion. I heard promotions were coming out this week, and those two people got promotions, better parking spots, better health care plan, and raises, and I'm sitting there like, what happened to me? I work as hard as they do. So, you know, convincing apology, you're thinking, oh, gee whiz, you know, and or, you know, look, I grew up, you know, my home, you know, was really miserable for me, and I just, all of a sudden, I felt like I was back there, but it wasn't them, it was you. And you're thinking, okay, well. And then what happens is we go back to the top of the list. We go back to fairy tale romance. All of a sudden, everybody calms down a little bit. Sun comes out. If your phone got broken, you might get a new one. Maybe you will, one way or another, start to feel better. For people who go up and down that cycle, more isolation, you get to the point where you barely have any friends or they don't want any parts of you because he's there, which is still perfect. Still, that's still a win for the guy that's trying to isolate you. More threats, like now you know, boy, when that guy raises his voice, I better do something different. I better leave the room. I better do something, or I don't know what's coming next because what happened last time, I'm still triaging from it, or I can't put enough makeup on to cover that. But there are people who go through this for months or years before they finally can't do it anymore and start working their way out. And there are people who've been doing it for half a century. I talked with a woman who was in her 70s, and she just got away from her husband. It's been going on for 50 years. It's insane. But it happens.
It's that damn roller coaster, right? And yeah. And what you described is what I describe as like, the love bombing is like the top of the roller coaster. Like that's the high, that's the happy, that's the excitement of what's coming. And then the very bottom is the end of that template.
Yeah. And it all goes back to buying the mask that we don't want to believe is a fake. If it's too good to be true, it's a mask. I'm sorry.
If it's too good to be true, y'all, it's bullshit. I wish you did not have the tragedy in your life that brought you to where you and I are having a conversation. But I will say that you are an example of what to do when tragedy strikes your life. You turned it into a mission to help others. And I'm just getting chills now talking about it. But you turned what could have literally broken you.
Sure.
And to some extent it did. You turned it into a mission. Thank you for always being so agreeable to talking to me about this type of thing, because I think it's so important to educate. And I think it's so important for people to realize just how dangerous these situations can be. It takes just a second for one of these situations to turn into something deadly. Just a second. And education, I mean, it truly is, knowledge is power, right? And so the more we teach people about these warning signs, teach people how to help someone who's in this type of relationship, I think then we're helping move the pendulum in the right direction. I agree with you. I don't think there's been enough progress because I've been doing this, I think I got licensed in 2002, so since 2002, but I have seen a change, but it takes people like you to help, and like Jake too, to help make this change. And so thank you for being such an amazing individual who has invested so heavily in this arena to help others.
I appreciate that. I mean, that's really amazing. Thank you. I can't wait till the next time you and Jake are just, you're good company, great people to be with. You're so knowledgeable. And I just feel like it's, you know, it's just like the best part of my life is to engage with people who are trying to do the same kind of things that I'm trying to do. And we know that every time we do anything, it helps somebody out there. So we're not just spinning our wheels, we're really helping. And I just feel like the key is, for me at least, to do what was never done for my daughter. I don't think she knew anything about dating abuse or domestic violence when she was 21 when this happened. You know, she didn't have a prayer. You know, she was dealing with the wrong guy. She was targeted by him and killed by him. And but I think we've saved a lot of people over the course of time. Not so much save them from getting killed, but at least save them from having a miserable time with a predator, quite frankly. Thank you.
Bill, I've known you now for 2 years when I started this podcasting journey, and really along the way, in addition to Jake, you have been kind of like the beacon of what I want to be, the beacon of hope, the beacon of change. And if this podcast today helps one person leave a dangerous relationship, then damn it, I've done something right by this world. And that's the goal.
And you know, I think of that every day. I think of the same thing. If, you know, I never want to feel like I'm wasting people's time listening to me or paying attention to what I'm doing, you know, the indication is I'm not wasting anybody's time, and it's helpful. And now and then I'll get a text message, or I'll get some review or something that pats me on the back in the right way that I actually can believe it, that it's working.
And I know you've gotten the messages. I know Jake has gotten the messages, and I know I've gotten some of those messages where someone reaches out, and I don't want to cry, that basically tells you thank you for saving their life. And that makes all of this worth the time and energy and the dedication. So again, love having you. And of course, I can't wait to have you back.
Yeah, same here.
But thank you so, so much for being here today. But why don't you let our audience know where they can find you?
I mean, the main place to go, I think, is whendatinghurts.com, because you can get to my book through there, which is on Amazon. You can catch up with the podcast through there, and you can catch up with me through there. So whendatinghurts.com, that's all you have to remember. It's pretty easy.
Which is a great podcast, by the way. Totally plugging it. Totally go listen to it.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much. And you were a great guest on there, too.
Well, you'll bring me back. I'm like, Bill is one of my favorite people that I've met on this journey. I'm like, he's just amazing. Plus, his wife spells her name the same way I do, so I like him.
It's true.
Really?
And my wife and I, by the way, dated 8.5 years, and we've been married now 50 and a half years.
I know.
Wow, congrats. That's huge. So you hit, oh my gosh, you hit the 50. That's amazing.
Yeah, like.
We probably met, and Jake wasn't even around. We met in 1967.
Yeah, I think that's probably true.
Yeah.
1967.
Mm. Michelle, did you officiate at their wedding?
No, I wasn't even an itch in my dad's pants yet.
And I don't know what your dad was carrying, if he was itching his pants, but we don't have time for that. Let's just go back.
But that is a picture I can't get rid of.
Right. Bill, I'm sorry. Michelle's going to do a disclaimer so you can sort of waiver your rights.
If you want to find out what Jake and I are up to, you can always follow me on Instagram or any other social media site. I forgot my own damn handle. Oh my God. That's how much Bill's affected me. If you want to find out about me, about what Jake's up to, you can reach out to us on Instagram, on all social media platforms. I'm at
Attorney Michelle Locke.
That's okay, Michelle.
Wow. All right. You want to find out what I'm up to? You can find me.
If you'll tell us.
Michelle Locke.
If you can get the words out, Michelle.
Talk to me. Write it down and hold
Michelle
it up.
Michelle Locke. Remember, Michelle's with one L, and you can thank my mother, Margot, with no T for that.
She has no teeth?
Also, no teeth. Oh. My mom spells her.
Bill, are you trying to get out of here, or are you trying to stay? I don't know.
This is more fun than what I was going to do.
Okay, there you go.
So my mother spells her name Margo.
Yeah.
Instead of Margot.
Go figure.
So after that explanation and Bill making me finally laugh this afternoon, I hope you all have enjoyed. I hope you all have learned something. And I hope that you take this information and help someone in your life that needs help. Have a great one.